about cars, Ferrari, Camaro, McLaren, Mustang, and even down to your granddad Zetzel. Welcome to No Driving Gloves, the car talk authority where experience, knowledge, and controversy share the same seat. Enjoy the ride. And now your host, John Viviani.
Welcome, everybody. It's No Driving Gloves, our Thursday, 9 o'clock Central Time. Our guest is on the West Coast, so not only does he get to enjoy California and the weather and that, he also gets to do this at 7 o'clock. I don't know where to even go. It's been a couple of months since we've done an interview on the show, and we kind of shied away from it. But we have Matt Stone on. He was presented to me by an agent who presents a lot of books. And I have my Lotus fetish. And then I have, that translates to a DeLorean fetish. And Matt wrote this book. And then as I've looked, we're going to get into a little bit more, I think, on that. I'm going to do this thing that I regret doing, but do it in 30 seconds, Matt. Give us a quick 30-second bio of you. Or I can try to do it.
I can do it, I think. 35-year automotive journalist and photographer, concourse judge, event MC, and anything pretty much to do with a camera and a microphone and a keyboard with cars. Car guy first, although trained in journalism and a lot of experience in racing photography and other stuff. And one day I quit my high-paying corporate job and said, it'd be a whole lot more fun hanging out of helicopters and taking pictures of cars. So that's what I did. I jumped off that grid, and here we are, like I said, 35 years, several magazine jobs, and 17 books later, and I'm still just the same car fool as y'all.
I didn't realize it was 17 books.
Well, welcome. And your book dropped today, yes?
I think it 17th. Was. Yeah, it was Tuesday it dropped.
Technical release date was Tuesday.
Got it. Kind enough to get a copy of the book pre-release. I'm going to say something really odd about this, Matt. It's one of the best smelling books I've ever. It's not a scratch and stiff, but however you guys did the printing and the pages, it does have a very pleasant aroma to it. It's very odd about a book.
It's that special ink.
Does it smell like the interior of a DeLorean? Is that the smell you were capturing?
I'm not sure I could make that comparison. I have never I've never judged anything that way. But I think the point is, and this is no joke, that ink is probably almost still wet because this thing was just off the press very recently. I mean, just in time for them in Taiwan, I believe Taiwan, Singapore, or wherever they print it, to box them up and get them here in time for you to get that and for me to get some copy. It is very much recently hot off the press. And I'm sure it was a little wet when it was packed. But yeah, it's all pretty minty fresh.
Well, there's a good reason to go ahead and get yours ordered right now. And we'll start with a plug on that. I could, on the description here, I have an Amazon affiliate link, but I know Amazon doesn't pay you a lot. Is there somewhere they can go directly to get your book if they find this interesting, or any order directly from you, or is Amazon the best place?
I don't actually sell them direct. So okay. No, not through. And I appreciate the thought there, but there's a couple of places I could turn you on to. One of them is you can buy publisher direct from motorbooks.com. I'm not sure if there's advantage or disadvantage to buying publisher direct, unless you're going to go buy several books at a time, and sometimes you can work out it that way. Amazon, the eponymous Amazon, is a good way because, of course, you might qualify for the free shipping and this and that and the other stuff, and they knock a few bucks off the MSRP. I don't remember the last price I saw there, but the retail price is $40 even, and this is hardbound and full color and all that. There is no soft cover version of this book. It's a hardcover only. And I, again, retail about $40, and I think it's 23 or 4 or 5 or something on the Amazon. So you'll save yourself a few bucks. If you want a signed and or personalized copy, there is a bookstore out here in Burbank, California that will arrange that for you called Auto Books. Their website is autobooks.com. auto-aerobooks.com. That's auto as in auto books, aero, A-E-R-O, because they carry a lot of aircraft bookage. Autobooks-aerobooks.com in Burbank, California. Call my friend Tina, who is the owner of the shop, and she will arrange to get a book in front of me, and I can personalize it to you, your dog, your girlfriend, your pet, your parakeet, I don't care, and sign it for you, one or as many copies as you want, and she will ship them to you. So that's the way, if you are one like me who loves personalized and autographed books, Tina at Autobooks, Aerobooks can arrange that for you. Those are kind of the options, really. And I don't know where else you may or may not find one, but if you'll definitely find one at all three of those places.
Auto Aerobooks is an amazing store. I wish we could have one in every city. And Amazon has your hardback for $34.33 today. And you can get it on Kindle, but you won't get the pleasant aroma there for about $27. But just to let everybody know.
What about $5 and change off? That's pretty good discount for a brand new release.
So it's always the way Amazon works.
And frankly, yeah. $40 for a hardbound book is cheap to begin with.
That's a deal. Yeah.
Yeah, it's 200 pages and a lot of photos that have never been seen or published before. And if you look at the cover, that brushed effect is supposed to replicate the stainless steel of a DeLorean skin. And that wasn't cheap either, but I credit Motor Books for doing that thing, because they spent money to make it right and feel good in your hands.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good quality book. It's embossed on the cover and the binding. So, I mean, it's a nice book to add to my book collection. Unfortunately, the co-host got PDF copies. I know how expensive it is to get books out to, you know, lowly podcasters. Like I said, I'm kind of a DeLorean fan because of the connection with Lotus and my Lotus history. And as a matter of fact, when I was at the Barber Museum, we were going through a bunch of stuff we bought from Classic Team Lotus just as they were cleaning out their warehouse. And we were unpacking it. We found John DeLorean's business card, the DMC business card in there. This could be an interesting piece. Not that I think Lotus really enjoys their affiliation, but I always found it, you know, always found that part interesting. What was your motivation in writing this book? What was the, you know, why did we jump in to do a book on DeLorean?
Couple of reasons, and I'll try to be succinct. First of all, I don't want to sell the book. I want to share the story. So this the whole DeLorean saga, if we want to call it that, is the story that people think they know. But I promise you, you probably do, John, know a lot of it. And you guys have know more of it than the average. But everybody's heard of Back to the Future, the big drug sting and the stainless steel and the gold. I mean, you know, everybody knows a little bit of it. But I don't think any previous book effort ever put it all in one place at one time. And certainly not recently. So that was my thought, is the story needed a good dusting off and some updating. And again, it's a story that people think they know, but they probably don't.
It's always odd to hear, and it irritates me, some of the stories about DeLorean and obviously the controversy about, what is that, 1983 at the Marriott. But that's just a small piece, and I'm part of the entrapment thoughts, but you know, I really don't know there.
Well, I cover all of that in the book. And there's no question that that was a contrived sting. I mean, that was proved beyond reasonable doubt. And of the however many dozens of charges against Sean DeLorean, he was acquitted of every one of them unanimously by the jury. But between the DEA and the FBI, that was a contrived sting without question.
See, that's where I've always believed. And when I try to, there was a DeLorean movie that came out a couple of years ago. And that's one of the things is I hate the stories about John that make him look guilty. And I thought they did a reasonable job in that. I'm sure you've seen that movie.
You're talking about Framing John DeLorean with Alec Baldwin.
Yes.
And yeah, that from everybody I have talked to that knew or worked with JZD, that they felt that was one of the more accurate portrayals of the entire scenario, good, bad, and otherwise. Everybody buys off and says, yeah, that's pretty much what happened. The only part we're just absolutely not sure of is a scene in there where he's supposedly working with bright lights and candles and aging documents or something. That's fishy. But just about all the rest of it is surprisingly accurate.
Yeah. And I'm going to jump in, John, if that's all right, because I think that's one thing that I really – and, yeah, we got the – Dave and I got the PDF preview. We didn't get the full book, so John may have – read a little more than we did, and I tried to peruse good sections and read as much as I could in the time I had. And one of the things I really like about your approach on this is that you took a holistic approach, right? I mean, the very first pages are his birth and growing up in the city of Detroit. I mean, that's very few people start all the way back there with John's story. And it's nice that you talk about the things that people forget from his early days in the industry with Chrysler and Packard and, you know, what, you know, his schooling and all of that, and understanding how he learned the business, right? And the things where he got his education and all of the things that led up to his stepping into General Motors and the GT Pontiac and the GTO and everything that happened. You know, and my connection with the DeLorean story, as I mentioned at the pre-show when we were kind of telling each other who we all were, I was the curator of transportation history at the Crawford Auto Aviation Museum in Cleveland, Ohio, which of course has car number one, which is car number two, but car number one off the line had to be destroyed because of quality issues. It's been a long time since I've recalled that story. So if I miss a few things, Matt, I apologize.
No, fair enough. And thank you for saying so, Derek. This is not a pure biography, but I couldn't put out such a huge story that was epicentered around one guy. I mean, he wasn't the only guy in the picture or gal or person, but it's not a pure biography, but that's where I had to start. And it is my belief, without getting overly philosophical, that we are where we've been. And I would say, to your point, John DeLorean was very much the product of where he had been. Engineering school and early days at car makers failed, and the 14th floor at GM, and all kinds of places that formed him. And I think the rest of the story would be on weak foundations without starting at John Z was born on blankety blanky in whatever, Michigan. So thank you for saying that. But I think it has to be that way, at least my way.
Yeah, 100% agree. Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, that's I really appreciated that part of it because it gives you the, as you say, that grounding and that foundation to understand all of his approaches through, you know, leaving GM and everything. That
David, your
turn. I was really struck by the contrast between the young, sort of shy, pure engineering type and the gray-haired showman that he became at the end, and the extravagant lifestyle, and what a turnabout that was, and how much of that must have been a product of just GM culture at that time and living so high in Detroit society that you kind of came to believe your own press. And then I thought those contradictions sort of showed up in his engineering approaches too. I mean, you've got the DeLorean, which is this attempt at building a really sophisticated ethical sports car for the 80s luxury market. And then you've got like the GTO, which is just this brawler with a solid axle in the rear and, you know, police car drum brakes and whatnot, which is this huge marketing success, but is not really like sort of an engineer's car per se.
Yeah. Not in terms of advanced engineering. That's true. Although it took some engineering and some political engineering to make that happen. I thought that was a brilliant stroke, and a lot of people aren't familiar. The GTO wasn't originally a model. A performance model. It was a special equipment package, which basically they took the big motor and stuffed it in the Tempest, and they took all the police parts and stuffed them underneath, and had a cool name and some badges and a four-speed transmission, and voila, the midsize American muscle car of the 60s is born.
Yeah, he slipped that one through the the board at GM somehow, because there's no way in the world they would have ever approved the GTO.
Yeah, the corporate loophole. Well, they approved it once it sold like 40,000 copies in the first year. And then for 65, yeah, let's do that again. But now it's a model. It's not a package. Mm-hmm. And the rest is history. Yeah, that was a particularly inspired bit of canoodling with him and his chief engineer and a wonderful marketing advertising wizard kind of guy named Jim. Help me, blank on it. That's not fair. But anyway, but him and three other guys sat in the literally dark room and cooked that whole deal up. Jim Wangers, excuse me.
Yeah, Jim. Yep, Jim Wangers. Yep.
They cooked this stew like nobody could have cooked it, and slid the whole thing right past everybody at GM. And of course, once it was successful, everybody thought it was the greatest idea in town.
Well, I think going to what Dave kind of was leading up to, I think, is, you know, it was almost being played out similarly at General Motors with Corvette, which, of course, John had gotten involved with, the Corvette studio or engineering studios. And, you know, the GTO was the brute American car. I mean, it was what mostly the young American, or maybe let's go even up to middle age American men wanted. And, you know, then over at Corvette, they're playing around. Corvette's still the brute, you know, sports car, you know, but they're playing around with this whole mid rear engine idea. And John's involved in the Reynolds aluminum and a couple of the other, you know, rear engine designs and all that. And he takes that. And, you know, although he was proud of the GTO, he wanted to build the refined, as Dave said, kind of that refined luxury mid-rear engine sports car that it seemed Corvette just couldn't quite pull off yet. And he took a big, big leap to do that.
Right off the balcony of the 14th floor of the General Motors. Yeah, that was a huge leap. But yes, you're right, Derek. That's a fascinating confluence that John was, DeLorean was looking at Porsche, at the Mercedes Gullwing, at the Mercedes C111 concept cars, which are mid-engine, looking at a lot of other cars that sort of had that type of mentality and yet understanding what was going on with the GTO and with the Corvette. And I believe all of those influences ultimately formed what he ended up doing.
Yeah.
So Derek, I was surprised that you didn't mention the Banshee in the process of that conversation. Well, because it struck me as being the closest to sort of the most public of DeLorean's thwarted dreams.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how Matt feels. Yeah, I mean, I think the Banshee was, but, you know, also, you know, the Reynolds aluminum Corvette, as well as blanking on the experimental number. Well, there
was the two-rotor and the four-rotor, and
the four-rotor was more, you know, the two-rotor was really mostly Zora on that. There was, you know, I think DeLorean was a little, but the four-rotor was heavily, heavily put in by DeLorean. And, you know, the four rotor even so much as, yes, the four rotor has the, you know, essentially gullwing style doors as well. So, you know, the Banshee, yes, I would say probably a mix of the Banshee and the four rotor, you could say are a lot of the inspiration of the DeLorean. Again, I'll let Matt speak.
I would say they were foundational elements. I would also say that he had tremendous respect as primarily or first an engineer. He had tremendous respect for the Germans, Mercedes and Porsche. And that's one of the main reasons there's gullwing doors on that car, is because he just thought that gullwing of the 50s and then again the C111 prototypes of the early 70s, those are all gullwing cars built and engineered by Mercedes. So that's a piece of that pie that's important. But yeah, there was influences from all other kind of places. The 914, 914-6, the 911. You know, the list was pretty great. And he also, considering the fact that he had Ital Design do the design work, says that he had great affection for what the Italian designers and engineers were doing. So this is the soup that became the DeLorean, for sure.
So, Matt, we have an interesting question from one of our listeners, Neil. And although he says in the comment, Dave, can you speak on the Cosworth Vega? Was that meant to compete with a similar model?
I think
DeLorean had major contributions to it, correct? However, Matt, you have a brief mention in your book about the Cosworth Vega project and DeLorean that I saw, you know, in the PDF preview. So I don't know if you want to talk about DeLorean's involvement in that.
And did the Cosworth Vega have anything to do with ultimately became a DeLorean? I don't know that I see that, but it certainly in a way was a response to the fact that John DeLorean got in charge of Chevrolet too late to fix the Vega before it came to market. And he said, and I think it's a big pull quote on one of the pages. I mean, this, he said, what an unbelievable disaster the Vega was. And by, you know, coming up with an engine that had some performance potential and had some better development and didn't melt down and rust upon contact, that I think that was a way to try to add some GTO-like pizzazz, perhaps, to the lowly Vega, because we all know they started rusting the day they came off the truck, and the engines were seizing by the time you got them home. And I'm sorry, Vega fans out there, that's just a fact. But a car that could have been good but wasn't, and DeLorean is absolutely contrite about it. He says, look, I saw these problems the minute I got there, but it was too late to fix them. The thing was production engineered and rolling down the hill. And I don't want to say he was embarrassed by that car, but I think he was.
Yeah. And, you
is
know,
that
guys,
why there was a job opening at Chevrolet?
I didn't hear that.
Is that why there was a job opening at Chevrolet, that the Vega was already failing?
I don't know that for a fact.
So
They promoted him above Chevrolet to take over all the car lines. All five of the brands and the buses and the trucks and a whole bunch of other stuff. I mean, he was North American king of General Motors. And that's what created an opening at Chevrolet beneath him when he got popped up to the 14th floor and took on that bigger job, which he hated. He just was very, he said, I'm the outcast. I'm the weirdo here. You know, these people they're not smoking what I'm rolling. And he was very frustrated as an engineer who wanted technological advancement, higher quality, better product, and he was thwarted at almost every turn by the bean counters. Funny you talk, but we were talking about the mid-engine Corvettes. There's a great photo in the book somewhere of a model of one of the mid-engine Corvette prototypes sitting on his conference table at his Manhattan office. So you don't think that was on the board? Then, of course, with the C8, we finally got there, because every other high-performance car around ultimately got there first, that I wonder if they would have gone, particularly with a Vanco-powered mid-engine Corvette at the time. I am guessing across these great United States, that would have tanked and would just, you know, the Corvette guys, and I don't mean this demeaningly, but that ain't my Corvette. You know, that may be called a Corvette or whatever, but that ain't my Corvette. And of course, now with the C8, you know, we're there. Funny.
Now I'm looking at that picture that you
took a lot.
I'm looking at that picture you referred to, and in the background, he's got the 914 on the wall with the engine highlighted, and the I guess at the time it would have been the Fiat X19. I wanted to call it Bertone X19. With that, couple of motorcycles, which of course are obviously mid-engine. So it's just, you can really get a sense when you're looking at that photo of some of his thinking in that. It looks like a posed photo, but you know what's going on and you got that feeling.
Yeah, the gathering of those materials in his little conference room, that tells you a lot about what was going on up here. And if you read his biography, there's a lot of discussion about so many meetings. So yeah, he for his own car with his own name on the building and on the badge, that's where he was going pretty much without question.
It's almost like maybe he got frustrated.
Ultimately, it's a rear engine car, though, isn't it?
Yes, technically it is. Yeah, but and that was a bit of a packaging. But I think I believe that as the DeLorean would have evolved, that engine would have moved a little further forward, and that weight balance would have come much more in line closer to figures. As an engineer, he knew that swinging a pendulum out the back is not the key to handling happiness. And I am very confident that would have been rectified with them. As a matter of fact, that brings up a thought. So many people say, well, where did it all go wrong? Was it the drug bust? Was it the... I believe and have been told by people in the know, and I agree with this, that DeLorean never had enough of anything to be successful. Not enough time, not enough money, not enough engineering and development prowess, probably not enough, and not enough economic good luck in the American market in the early 80s, that if there would have been, you know, another $50 million on the table and 25 more really good engineers and another 2 years' time, could have made it, might have made it. I do know there were several interesting products under development, and they had a plan for that brand and for that company. And that included a four-seater, a Gullwing four-seater, and a variety of utility type vehicles, buses and trucks and all kinds of things. And I believe given the time, the money, given just a little more of everything, that company and brand had a few.
I'm trying to.
Do you draw any parallels with Preston Tucker?
Well, you know, two rebel car maker guys. One comparison I do not make is I have no doubt in my mind, in every book and every pile of documents I have seen, heard, and read, that the big three, as it were at the time, put Tucker down. I have no question about it. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I have read enough to know and seen enough documentation that the mechanism they used was the securities fraud and all that, but they were scared of Tucker. Here's this fabulous car that's gorgeous and seats six and performs really well and it's safe. What's with that? Advanced engineering and all that. And that car, I believe, frightened a lot of the folks in Detroit. I don't believe in any way that any of the Detroit car makers conspired, let's say, to put DeLorean down. He bought components from most of them. He was a customer, a paying customer. And even though, you know, he probably didn't have as many friends left in General Motors at the time, he bought a lot of Harrison air conditioners and other systems, that cooling systems and a lot of other things that put money in GM's pocket and had a lot of friends in Detroit, guys like Roger Penske and many, many more, that I don't make that connection at all. What happened to Tucker happened to DeLorean. But in the sense of, were they both certainly promoter types? Sure. Visionaries? Absolutely. I'll give them both that credit liberally.
Can I go the other way on that? Because when Dave asked that question, I was going to ask the question jumping ahead in time. Are there parallels between DeLorean and Musk because of some of the design influences and that? Yes, Musk was not the engineer that DeLorean was. But Musk had that one component DeLorean needed most, was the money. And some of his, do you see some of DeLorean in Musk or Musk's automobiles?
I do. A little bit of the rebel spirit, so to speak. I you know, neither one of them were, you know, ultimately proved to be real corporate type guys, obviously. And I think it is fascinating that the Cybertruck, I don't know what's very cyber about it, but uses a stainless steel skin. That's no accident. Yeah, there's some parallels there. Were they like characters? I don't know, but there were some similarities that you could connect a few dots here and there between the both bright guys and clearly somewhat rebel souls, you might say. and innovators, and just believe in something so strongly, almost they're forces of nature. That's probably where I would put those two guys most similarly. John, if I've answered your question.
I think you have. And we're getting some chatter in the comments, and I was going to put it off till a little bit later, but we're actually now talking the past and we're talking the future as DeLorean was looking. And one of the questions we had is, did DeLorean like the movie, which I believe without the movie, most of us wouldn't know what a DeLorean is today, or would have he preferred they stayed with the refrigerator, which was the original time machine?
You know, I don't know. I have not read any commentary of his about Back to the Future. Although people need to understand, and I explained this whole thing in the book, that DeLorean had already shuttered its doors when those movies came out. It isn't like the movies could have saved the car, or the movies, why didn't the movie save the car? Because the company was already closing when the movies came out by several years. So those twains never met. I think he would have enjoyed it, honestly.
Consolidated Industries would have reaped that reward.
I believe he would have enjoyed it because it put his car in a fascinating sparkly light. And he would have enjoyed that. And he also was very future thinking and had great respect for design, engineering, and technology. And I think that all of that, he would have understood it, and I think he would have liked it. That's my belief. Having you know, not known the man personally, but based on everything I do know about him, I think he would have got it and he kind of would have liked it.
I believe definitely as time played out, he would have liked it because it kept DeLorean relevant. And I think that's why we got him, you know, still talking about cars up until really his death. And I believe he dealt in watches for a period of time. You know, it's, I think the movie did a great deal of keeping the car relevant. I think it's contributed a lot to what we see today.
I agree. And in terms of making the car interesting in pop culture, not just as, you know, cheap transportation with funny doors and shiny skin. I think it made it a bit of a pop culture hero, if not an icon, and kept it relevant in the pop culture discussion about cars. I believe that absolutely.
Yeah, I recently upgraded my 3D printer and did a additive manufacturing to a...
Cool.
DeLorean. I need to do the painting and the vinyl work to it. But I just don't see that many other cars from the early 80s. And on all the models out there, there's not a lot of 82 Corvettes you can print out, but there's a bunch of DeLoreans and a lot of DeLorean time machines.
For sure.
It'd be better if you could print an 83.
Rare, wouldn't they?
So Matt, one of the things I glazed over when I was introducing myself to you, I was the director of collections and chief curator for the National Corvette Museum for 5 years. So
didn't know that.
Derek keeps saying quiet.
Yeah, I'm pretty quiet. So, but you know, you brought up the Cybertruck came into the conversation with its, you know, stainless steel panels, and you know, we were probably going to try to glaze over that, if we will. Neil, one of our avid listeners, asked what you think. You know, would John DeLorean have liked the idea that Musk has in using that again, or do you think John DeLorean might have, if he was still around and he and Elon were working together on that project, would he have recommended something different based on his experience with DeLorean? If you don't know, but do you venture a guess on whether DeLorean would think it was smart?
I do not know for a fact, because we couldn't look back at the mindset of a guy that died, you know, 25 years ago and prognosticate too much about what he would like about, you know, mid-2020s technology and design. Would he have liked the look of it? I don't know. Potato, potato. Everybody has their own taste. I do not care for it. I don't get it. I don't get that car at all. But John DeLorean very much embraced future technology. He held purchased numbers of patents, composite technology and alloys and metals. And he was very, very much about that. And if a high performance EV was, you know, part of the landscape now with a living, breathing DeLorean company, I don't think he would have shunned that at all. I believe he would have got it and probably embraced it. And it's funny because there are some of the DMC-12s that have been converted to EVs. There's an outfit in Europe that does them. And you know, boy, they are fast, as you might expect. And with the batteries and motors, the motors are mounted low and a little forward of where they were, and the batteries go where the fuel tank used to be. And I mean, the DMC-12 makes a Jim Dandy EV with all the right parts and stuff put in it. I think John DeLorean, I believe, would have loved that idea, or at least embraced it. And again, in today's market, if that was a way to be a trendsetter and a leader, I think he very well could have gone there.
Well, we get a lot of that. I'm going to throw Lotus back into it because of the DeLorean tie, because Chapman was always forward technology and forward thinking, and everybody's going, oh, he'd hate these electric, you know, the electric Lotus and things like that. And I think it's the exact same thinking. No, Chapman would have loved it. Chapman would have been all over it, because you're never going to get it. And there's a video out on YouTube. I don't know if any of you have seen it. Go look it up. But it's that, is it the McBurney or whatever, that little itty bitty electric car that appeared at Goodwood, races a Porsche 911 Turbo, or 911 GT3. And a drag race. And basically, before the Porsche's rolling, the little electric car's done.
It's so comical. I've seen that video, and it is absolutely comical. Yeah. You know, think about it. You got maximum torque at zero RPM. What else would you want in drag racing than that?
I mean, we're going to have to figure out new ways to define cool cars. I'm going to pivot the conversation a little bit. I'm going to ask you a question, and then I want to pivot to and talk about some of your other books and interests, because you're not a DeLorean expert, and we keep asking you to theorize how John DeLorean would think, and I don't know if that's somewhere you want to be. But when in this book, my question wants to be, what was the most surprising or interesting thing you discovered about DeLorean doing the research for this book? Or should we leave that alone?
I'm happy to go there, because there were a couple of things. Of course, many types of people in the sphere wrote him off as an arrogant playboy. Okay, sure, he married, you know, two beautiful supermodels in his life and dated many more and actresses and all of that. But he certainly could be arrogant, and he had his arrogant moments. But when you read his autobiography, all in his first person voice, he brings up cauldrons of humility that not a lot of people would believe. I mean, he blames himself for a lot of DeLorean's failures. He apologizes to his family. He's one of his great quotes, and I love this. He says, "Hey, my credibility shattered. Would you buy a car from me now?" That takes huge cojones just to say that. And I give him nothing but credit. There is a huge element of humility to him that not a lot of people are aware of. And the other thing that really blew me away, once I started reading the transcripts of the trial, of the big drug trial, is how shoddily that whole deal was put together by the FBI and the DEA. I mean, it was a really ramshackle deal. And the fact that they go to court and try to prove that, no, this was all legitimate and we caught the fish. Well, you know, the fish was just trying to save his company. And he had a guy who was a DEA informant saying, oh, I can get you sources of financing. Now, everybody says when they see that that videotape from the Sheraton Hotel Room 502, everybody says, why didn't he, when they opened up that suitcase full of cocaine, why didn't he just run out of the room? And he addresses that in his autobiography. He says, look, I was receiving death threats for me and my wife and my kids and my family. And several of them was, you walk out of that hallway without that briefcase in your hand, you're dead. So, you know, it just was, as I read through the transcripts and noticed how his defense team researcher picked that whole line of BS apart, it struck me as how completely ramshackle that whole Sting thing was. It's disgusting. No, those are my two takeaways. John DeLorean had deep and great humility that a lot of people were not aware of. And two is that whole bus was stuck together with, you know, paper clips and glue. And that's about it.
Yeah, that's when I started enjoying DeLorean, or really started to become fascinating, is when I read his autobiography. I've got a first edition of his autobiography. And then further on, I have Barry Weiss's book, who supposedly was the guy that turned the lights off in the factory, yeah, and how he writes about DeLorean.
Yeah, that guy, Barry Wills, was a fountainhead of information. And I'd say his book, called John Z, The DeLorean and Me, mm-hmm, is something I would recommend to anybody who really wants to know a deeper version of the story. This guy was there at the factory, in the office, on the factory floor. And you're right. He put the place together and unfortunately had to take it apart. But that's a marvelous book. John Z, mm-hmm, Me, John Z, and the or John Z and Me and the DeLorean. So anyway, Barry Wills.
It was really cool.
B-A-R-R-I-E. And it's a book you can still buy. It's not cheap, but it's around and it's worth having. And it tells an even deeper story than I had room for about what all was going on in Belfast. And that's fascinating. The third thing that I'll re-answer your question just again a little more, John, that I was fascinated by is I figure here's a guy who, you know, was on the verge of going to prison for who knows how long, and his marriage was shattered and his business closed and all that. And I figured, you know, he would be the first one to blame putting the factory in North Ireland. And he had nothing but glowing things to say about the people in Belfast, his employees, families, the factory workers. He said, those people are wonderful. They have spirit. They have grit. And they worked hard. Some of them, this was their first job ever. Some of those guys never worked. They were a painter. Or they hauled trash or whatever. This was their first job that involved training, consistent hours, work, a living wage, and benefits. It was unheard of in Belfast at the time. Absolutely unheard of. With a 30%+ unemployment rate. These people were thankful. When John DeLorean walked in, it was like, oh man, the second coming of, you know, somebody. But Moses, Jesus, pick one. But he absolutely spoke glowingly of those people and would not pin the tail on that donkey. He shared the blame with Margaret Thatcher and this one here and that one there. But he mostly puts a lot of it square on his shelf, on his own shoulders, and accepted responsibility and admitted what he did wrong. And again, that's, like I say, the humility that a lot of people are. I'm damn disappointed that I never met him and wish that I had.
So you've written, I can't remember what we said at the beginning, 15 books, 20 books. You've got a bunch 17. Of books under your.
Not that I'm counting, but 17.
17. Yeah, see, I knew 15 to 20.
More than 15, less than 20. Okay, I'll take that.
What's a few more of your titles in that? Because there's one that I want to ask you about particularly, which is Winning the Racing Life of Paul Newman. Was that in conjunction with the Adam Carolla movie, or are you independent of that?
No, the movie was in conjunction of this book. They licensed, Adam's production company licensed that book and used it as the footprint for the film. So I did the book first. And then they came to me and said, how can this is we want to tell this story because Adam loves Newman and loves his car. Adam has several of his cars and we want to do this as a documentary. And you've given us the footprint. And so they licensed the book and the story from Motor Books and from me. And that's kind of how that went. I would say of all my titles, what I'm probably best known for is the Holy Trinity of Hollywood car guys. And that would be books about Steve McQueen, Paul Newman, and James Garner. So those three are that's probably my triumvirate of really cool car guy books. But I have done a bunch of Mark histories, I've done some buyer's guides. I did a Jaguar E-Type book, a Mustang 4.6 and 5 liter book. I've done now a couple of Porsche books and one on Porsche racing, the IROC International Race of Champions Season 1, which, as you'll recall, was run with 3-liter Porsche RSRs. One called My First Car, 365 Cars You Must Drive, which was kind of a real fun look at, okay, let's pick out, you have a car guy's year to live. What do you need to drive every day? Something. So I did that in concert with a guy named John Matris and Automotive Myths, Mysteries, and stuff like that. It was a fun myth-busting kind of a thing. That's the moral of it, I would say. And you can learn about the rest of my titles on my website, although you can't buy them because I don't accept your money on my website. Please visit me at mattstonecars.com. And I think most of my titles are listed there somewhere. And but I take great pride in most of the ones I've done, all of them at some level or another. But I'm particularly proud of the IROC Porsche book because that was a magical moment in time. You take those dozen drivers, which included Formula One champions, Indy winners, NASCAR drivers, a marvelous group of guys. It was all men at that time, as you might imagine. And today, $1 billion would not put that back together. You know, you're going to get John Force and every great and the last 5 Indy winners and the last 5 Formula One champions and Lewis Hamilton, and it goes on and on and on. You know, to put those guys in a dozen cars and take them around the country and race them against each other today with all the sponsorship issues and everything else, that would be a $1 billion bet. So to me, that was great fun. And I went to one of those races back at Riverside Raceway when I was a much younger guy with her. And some that was even black. But that I'm particularly proud of because that was a story that was, you know, 25 magazine articles, but nobody ever put it together as a proper book. And the 3 Hollywood car guys, I had more fun than you can imagine doing that. And getting to know those guys' stories and meeting a couple of them. Steve McQueen died when I was a sophomore in college, so I never met him, but I did get to speak with Paul Newman and met James Garner personally over the table and talked to him. And those guys were just magical guys. I mean, besides just great American hero stud actors, they were all very competent racing drivers and interesting characters. So I'm particularly proud of those 3 and this one. I'm really happy with the way this came out. I told the story in DeLorean that I wanted to tell, and I hope everybody out there finds it enjoyable and fascinating. That to me is important. It has to be a story that I want to tell. Otherwise, why would I do it?
Say, I didn't put one and one together, but I have my first car in my library. And going back to the Garner Newman thing, which one I restored Paul Newman's Lotus X180R that he raced for a few races at one point in time. But who got who into racing? Was it Garner that got Newman into racing, or was it the other way around?
No, Newman did that pretty much by himself. Although I'll answer that in more detail in a second. I believe James Garner and Steve McQueen were neighbors at the time in the 60s in Brentwood, California. They both had magnificent houses up on the hill with, you know, views of the ocean. And James Coburn lived right down the street. That's the kind of neighborhood. And I believe that James Garner, besides doing Grand Prix, that James Garner saw his little badass boy brother Steve McQueen having a lot of fun racing cars and making racing movies. And I believe that was a big influence there. Newman made a movie with Robert Wagner in 1968 called Winning, about the Indianapolis 500, running the Indy 500 and all that. And I talked to Robert Wagner about that. And that was a thrill, too. Let me tell you, that is one cool dude, R.J. Wagner. And he said, you know, he says, you could just tell. He says, we had to learn and drive and act like racing drivers. And he says, we were at the Speedway in Gurney Eagles, and we're out there lapping at not quite pole speeds, but he says, you know, we're cooking. And he says, I did it because I had to, and I wanted to learn to be better. And he says, I got to be competent enough that I fooled most of the people some of the time and didn't kill myself. That's a quote. He said, but you could see it in Paul. He said Paul would pull in off the track, and he said you could see the eagles in his eye. That's a marvelous one. He said, the light of eagles in Paul's eyes. He said, yeah, just flicked on the switch for him. And, you know, it wasn't a few years later when he was a very, very competent sports car racer.
Well, in the end, and if I remember correctly, because we've had Nate Adams from Chassis Media on the show and Matt DeAndrea and a couple of those guys that are all involved with Chassis and the movie, didn't Newman... he ended up liking or enjoying racing more than being an actor, or technically he was a better actor than most of us, but he's also a better race car driver than most race car drivers.
I think, John, the quote that to me answers your question as succinctly as possible. He said, in racing, I could get away from the rubbish of Hollywood. He hated the gossip and the paparazzi and, you know, all of that Hollywood stuff. He just didn't. Of course, he had a lot of friends in the business, and some of his best friends were actors and all that. But the rubbish side, he did not like one bit. And he said at the track, he was just one of the guys, and he wanted to go race. And that's all he wanted to do. He wasn't movie star Paul Newman. He was racing driver P.L. Newman.
PLN on the helmet.
Yep.
Derek and Dave, we got about 90 seconds left with Matt because we told him an hour. Any last questions? I'll be quiet from here.
Oh, yeah. I really wanted to know what your process was for researching and writing these books. I mean, what's your routine like when you put one of these things together?
For the first several months, I just go into gathering mode. I watch every video, watch every movie, watch every documentary, get by every book and get every document and interview. I mean, I just gather and I have a banker's box or three, and I just pile the stuff in there. I don't start writing a word until I have gathered. And then I spend some time reading and assembling and assimilating. And then I have to go start filling in holes because there's a question here and there. And then I don't really start writing till about month number 5 or 6. And then I'll spend another 6 months or 8 months, whatever, actually boning out the copy and the captions and all that. But I sponge for at least 6 months. And then I start assimilating internally all this material. And that kind of gives me the story that I want to tell, as I said a few minutes ago. Develop the story. And I don't mean my version of it, because there has to be truth and legitimacy, but it's the story that's meaningful, I believe, to me and other enthusiasts, and tell the story I want to tell. And that's at least a year-long process, and it starts with just sponging everything I can find and weeding out the chaff and some of the crap and the stuff that's just not any value to what I'm doing, and saving the nuggets, especially if it's first-person interview material with the people who were there. That's critical. I hate third person information. Did I answer your question?
Primary sources, gotta love them. Thank you. Yes, very sure. Much. Thanks, Derek.
Anything else, Derek, on your mind?
I do have a question. Again, I didn't get the copy of the book, so I didn't dive into everything. But are you aware of the materials that the Western Reserve Historical Society in Cleveland, Ohio, holds on DeLorean?
Most
people, unfortunately, don't know what's there because it's not really processed and cataloged, nor do they really talk about it for some reason, which I find unfortunate. But of course, the car that carries VIN number one is there in the collection. But along with that came when Consolidated Industries did liquidation and all that. That was the name of the company, right? Did I say it right? Double check me. Yes, thank you.
International.
Okay. Yes, international. There you go. But there's, you brought up the four-door sedan version that was planned for the car. There are some drawings that, at least in the PDF kind of short version we got of the book, I didn't see the drawings that I know are at at the Crawford and the Western Reserve Historical Society collections. They're similar to the ones you have in your book, but there are differences in the drawings that are there. So might just be something that you might want to dig into just to see. And again, it's been 7.5 years since I left there. So I'm recalling from memory, 7 years ago or more, what's there, but it might be interesting to you to look at. I was fascinated by the things that had there.
And I will say, I want to thank my friends at Ital Design Giugiaro in Torino, Italy, which is where the car was designed. And also, they sent me hundreds of design drawings, sketches, renderings, and photos of chassis bucks and clays. All that's in the book. And most of this stuff has never been published, never been outside of Italy. And to me, that's one of the Easter eggs of this book, is the materials I got from Ital Design. That, you know, they didn't run that stuff in Motor Trend and Car and Driver back because it was too soon. But there's pictures of the foam of the car, of the four-door, the DMC-24, the four-seater, and a chassis buck that shows clearly two rows of seats, the engine in the back and the other bulkhead in front. And I mean, these are the building blocks of the future product they were working on developing. And miraculously, Ital Design had them and could find them and shared them with. So that I have shared with everybody that reads this book. And it's stuff I promise you the club newsletters probably don't have.
Fantastic.
Say with that, and thank you for spending so much time with us tonight, Matt. I'm going to have to say you have to stick around a minute after we end this recording to get everything uploaded.
Thank you.
I do thank you for your time. For our listeners, I'm going to, when you get to go to the audio podcast, I'll have links to all of Matt's books, including the DeLorean book. They may be affiliate links, so we may make a couple of cents on those. So we won't ask you to buy us a coffee. Get the QR code and buy us a coffee. But we do thank you.
Well, you're welcome, John and guys. I appreciate the chance to share the story about the story. I'm very happy and proud of this book, and I believe it's hopefully a story that most automotive enthusiasts would find something that they can have and enjoy. And like I say, it's a whole lot of material that ain't been seen either in decades or ever. And I'm very proud of that because, you say it's a 30 or 40-year-old story, but there's new stuff in that book. Thanks again.
Definitely thank you. Starik and Dave are quiet. But we'll let them go. We'll see you guys next Thursday.
All right. Thank you, Matt.